Welcome to Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the rare disease community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're in New York today, speaking with Dr. Heather Landau of the Sloan Kettering Memorial Cancer Center on Manhattan's Upper East Side. Dr. Landau is a board-certified oncologist and hematologist and an expert on multiple myeloma as well as amyloidosis. She received her medical degree from Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, followed by a residency in internal medicine from the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center, and later a fellowship in hematology oncology from Memorial Sloan Kettering. And since March is National Amyloidosis Awareness Month, we're here, of course, to talk about amyloidosis. Dr. Landau, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So please tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, your background, and how you developed your specialty in this particular field.
Sure. I did my fellowship here at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and I was always interested in the hematologic malignancies since I did cell biology back in undergraduate. And so when I came here, I was very interested in pursuing a career in blood cancers. In truth, I met my mentor who had an infectious enthusiasm for amyloidosis, Dr. Ray Comenzo, who did some of the pioneering work in stem cell transplant for this disease. And he introduced me to this topic, and I felt no better way to spend my career than to take care of patients. I really went into medicine to make sick people well. And these were very sick patients that could really ultimately benefit from our care.
Very interesting. It's also kind of an obscure disease. If you don't know somebody who has it or yourself have it, you've probably never heard of it.
That's right. Yeah. So that's one of the problems with the disease. And that's why patients often are diagnosed late, because the symptoms of the disease mimic more common conditions. So when patients show up to their primary care physician or even a cardiologist, per se, with nonspecific symptoms, they're really, the providers don't necessarily think of amyloidosis as the first potential on the differential.
Just so you and our listeners understand, we cover two diseases, transthyretin amyloid polyneuropathy, or ATTRPN, and transthyretin-mediated amyloid cardiomyopathy, known as ATTRCM. Can you explain the similarities between these conditions and maybe the differences?
Amyloidosis, systemic amyloidosis, is a conglomerate of different diseases, because each of the amyloid diseases starts with a precursor protein that can be unique. So the two transthyretin-based diseases, both cardiomyopathy and polyneuropathy, start as the result of a misfolded protein that is produced in the liver, the transthyretin protein. And that is the precursor protein that misfolds into the substance called amyloid and deposits in either the nerves, in the case of polyneuropathy, or in the heart, in the case of cardiomyopathy. But that's a distinctly different, those are distinctly different diseases than light chain amyloid, which the precursor protein is a immunoglobulin, really a fragment of an immunoglobulin that's produced by bone marrow-based, typically plasma cells that are pathologic and produce these abnormal light chains. And it's that light chain entity that misfolds into the substance called amyloid and deposits in places like the heart, the kidneys, the GI tract, the nervous system, and the liver. But the precursor protein for TTR or AL are distinctly different, and the treatment for each of these entities are distinctly different.
Okay. So as I understand it, these are different diseases. And as I understand that light chain, AL amyloidosis, is the most common type, at least here in the United States, with roughly 4,500 new cases diagnosed each year, most of them men.
I would say that statistic is probably changing a little bit, because we are recognizing the wild type of transthyretin-based amyloidosis. Now that we have drug development in this space, I think that providers and patients are becoming aware that this may be even more common. than light chain amyloidosis because as we age, mostly men, older men, their liver takes a wild type or a normal transthyretin protein that begins to misfold, similar to a man developing prostate cancer. If you live long enough, you may develop wild type TTR. AL amyloidosis was the most common amyloid disease detected in the United States and the developed world prior to the advent of drugs that were now directed towards TTR amyloid because the TTR amyloid cases were really not being diagnosed because there was no awareness.
So relative to light chain amyloidosis, how rare are these other two?
I think it's a hard question right now because the numbers are changing as the awareness is increasing. I think that they're all rare diseases, don't get me wrong. I think the awareness is really driving the incidence of diagnosis substantially.
And I want to get to that in a minute. But before I move on, about the light chain amyloidosis, usually, from what I've read, it affects people from ages 50 to 80. And although there are some patients diagnosed much younger, even in their 20s, and this is caused by a bone marrow disorder, right?
Right. So that's what I was explaining. So in our bone marrow, we have different cells, and there's one particular cell, typically a plasma cell, that can produce this abnormal light chain, which is the precursor to amyloid in the setting of light chain amyloidosis. So yes, it's a bone marrow disorder. It starts in the bone marrow.
Unusually, or curiously, and I'm not sure why, maybe you can tell me, one of the most common of the, I understand, 130 variants of the polyneuropathy is endemic, particularly in Portugal. And from what we read, the onset of this phenotype usually is before the age of 50. Why is that?
Yeah, so I think it has to do with the mutational capacity of the TTR protein. Because there's all these different mutations, these genetic variants. So I was talking before about the wild type TTR types of amyloidosis, which actually occur or increase in prevalence as patients or our population ages. But the hereditary variants actually are frequently seen in younger patients because these are inherited disorder or mutations that we see in the transthyretin protein that then predisposes that protein to misfold into amyloid, and different mutations will have different amyloidogenic capacity.
Would you say that the hereditary varieties of this disease are more rare than not?
Yeah. So I would say hereditary variants of amyloid, TTR amyloid, or other types of amyloid, there's many other genetic variants in different proteins, not just TTR, are much rarer than TTR wild type or light chain amyloidosis.
Got it. So I want to get to the awareness issue. And from that, I'd like to come to the Amyloidosis Foundation and their role in sponsoring your research.
Yeah, so I am grateful that actually I was awarded a funding for a fellowship. And I think that this is going to be key to helping the community developing not only expertise in the disease, but also awareness. I think that the more young people we train to become not only amyloidologists, but also as part of our fellowship, we are introducing a segment that requires more community outreach in order to start educating the community. It's really hard to do because everybody's time is really limited.
Is that a thing, amyloidologist? It's a new term
yes,
for me.
Yes, no, I think we use it here and there.
Okay. The National Awareness Month is March coming up. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean in terms of actual activities and promotion and awareness campaigns, et cetera?
I think a lot through the patient support groups like Amyloid Foundation. There's an amyloid support group that does a really great job with patients, and Amyloid Research Consortium are the three big amyloid patient support organizations, I think, in the U.S. at least. And I think that they do a great job of spreading awareness in any forums that they can, to try to both market to the professionals and the patients in terms of symptom recognition, awareness of research that is being done at centers of excellence and elsewhere, pairing patients with experts in the disease, because again, it's really disconcerting when a patient shows up to a provider's office and even if they have a diagnosis and the provider says, oh, I've never heard of that before. It happens quite a bit. I've never actually seen a patient with amyloidosis.
Well, how many patients, I know it's difficult to say, but how many patients have amyloidosis at any given time? What is the prevalence?
Yeah, so we said that 3,000 to 4,000 are diagnosed per year with AL, I'm talking about.
Right.
Focused here. And patients are living quite a bit of time. It's the patients who present with advanced cardiomyopathy are at high risk of having poor outcomes. But independent of that, now that we have drugs that really can treat this disease pretty effectively, patients are living with this disease.
I want to talk to you a bit about that in the little time we have left, because life expectancy, of course, can range from what, half a year to maybe 10 years.
Or more. Much more.
Much more. So what does the treatment, the therapy scene look like? You say it's improved dramatically.
Dramatically. So before 2021, we had zero FDA-approved treatments for this condition. In 2025, it's sad but true, but we only have one FDA-approved treatment for this condition, but it happens to be very effective.
And what's that?
So daratumumab in combination with bortezomib, cyclophosphamide, and dexamethasone, the DARA-VCD regimen, has really shown in a randomized trial to improve response rates or complete hematologic response rates, triple response rates, double organ response rates, and has led to the first approval of a drug treatment in the first line setting and leads to about 60% of our patients going into a complete hematologic response, which is our goal.
And when was the drug approved by the FDA?
January 2021.
Tell us just quickly about your research, the grant. How much is the grant? What's the duration of the grant? And what are you actually working on?
The grant that I was awarded by the Amyloid Foundation actually supports a clinical and research fellow. It's a fellowship opportunity where I will be able to, through a multidisciplinary strategy, train somebody who can then, again, disseminate knowledge and become an expert in the disease. And more experts, more awareness, more patients are diagnosed, and more programs develop the expertise to be able to diagnose and treat this disease. But this fellow will be responsible for research. The research that we're currently focused on is developing new therapies for this condition, namely T-cell redirecting therapies, chimeric antigen receptor.
CAR T.
Yeah. So we are doing the first CAR T-cell trial specifically for AL amyloidosis that's currently open and accruing at MSK, and we have just passed our safety metric and now are opening it to other centers.
Interesting. And very briefly, what else can we talk about in terms of your current research and also research outside the United States internationally?
Yeah, so I think that another big topic is going to be bispecific antibodies, other T-cell redirecting therapies that are being developed for this condition. Those are all very exciting and very potent therapies because, again, as I said, we have one regimen that's approved for this condition. But after your first line therapy, again, 60% of patients achieve a complete hematologic response. That leaves about 30 to 40% who need additional therapy. And we don't have anything in that space. So developing these potent therapies. We have more targeted therapies because half our patients carry this genetic abnormality in their plasma cells, the translocation 1114, and that renders the plasma cells uniquely responsive to BTK and inhibitors such as venetoclax, which is being developed in this space and very potent for our patients as well. But none of these drugs are approved. We're looking at different endpoints. We're looking at different depths of response, something called minimal residual disease negativity. How can we actually measure that in the blood instead of in the bone marrow to prevent our patients from having to go through invasive procedures? We're looking at ways to monitor patients to keep them out of the hospital by using remote monitoring technologies. and certain things like that.
Just one question, and this is not directly related to what your work is, but frequently people with multiple myeloma will develop amyloidosis.
10% of patients have both diseases at diagnosis.
And what's the prognosis for somebody with both diseases?
It's worse because patients with AL independent of multiple myeloma typically have less proliferative clone. So once we get the disease in remission, it is not as common for the disease to relapse and remit the way that a patient with multiple myeloma does who has a proliferative clone. But if you have both phenotypes, you tend to have a more relapsing remitting course. Whereas in the patients who have true AL without any myeloma or even a high burden of plasma cell disease, once you get them into remission, they can stay in remission for decades.
Any final thoughts?
I think the future is bright. The future is bright. Finally, pharmaceutical companies are partnering with us to try to develop drugs in this space. For many years, because of the risk of sudden cardiac death in patients who presented with advanced cardiomyopathy, nobody wanted to study their drugs in a patient population who had a risk of sudden cardiac death. So I think that we're in a much better space. So that's why we've lagged behind the drug development paradigm compared to multiple myeloma. But I think that it's being recognized that these patients can really benefit from therapies. The other things that are being developed are antifibrillar antibodies or light chain stabilizers, because even if you get patients into a deep hematologic remission, it takes a long time for the organs to improve. And if we can hasten that, patients can get better more quickly.
We're exactly out of time. We've been talking with Dr. Heather Landau at Sloan Kettering Memorial Cancer Center here in New York City. Thank you very much for your time. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.